You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
The score was 0-0 after Canada played Honduras last week in a World Cup soccer qualifier in Toronto. In the run-up to the previous World Cup, the democratically elected president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya, was overthrown in a military coup and replaced by a violent regime that some argue internationally has been most supported by Canada. In short, Canada versus Honduras is more than just a game. Tyler Shipley is a writer-researcher based in Toronto, teaches at York University. He recently launched a new online magazine called Left Hook, which brings together progressive and critical views on popular sport. And that is where Tyler's article on the political context of the Honduras-Canada soccer match first appeared. But Tyler now joins me by phone from New York. Good morning, Tyler, and welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, the World Cup is played every 4 years. The last time was in South Africa. It was just after the coup regime took power. What role or what maneuvers, what ways did the Honduran coup regime try to take advantage of the World Cup 3 years ago in South Africa?
Well, I mean, I think part of the reason I started the journal Left Hook was to try to start talking about how important sports are, popular sports are, in building the sort of political legitimacy for various different political positions. And obviously the ones I'm concerned about are the ones that are not progressive. And, you know, it started with thinking about some of the ways that Canada uses professional hockey to justify and build support for the occupation of Afghanistan, and then that, you know, you sort of transplant that into Honduras, and you find out that the Honduran regime was, of course, you know, doing the same thing and was well aware of how powerful it would be to line itself up with the Honduran soccer team. So they did a number of things. The one sort of story that I found most compelling was that once Honduras won the match that gained entry into the World Cup, the coup regime immediately engineered a sort of a parade through the city with very strategic stops at places where members of the regime, members of the new military regime, could have big photo opportunities, major sort of ceremonies around themselves, associating themselves with the successful soccer team. And of course, one of those stops would be at the presidential palace, where the team was meant to hand over, you know, autographed sweaters to the de facto military president. That was one thing that they attempted to do, and of course that was the sort of entry into the piece I wrote, because that sort of got derailed a bit by the captain of the team, who preferred to send his sweater to the president in exile, President Manuel Zelaya, who was at that point holed up in the Brazilian embassy. So that was one of the ways that they attempted to use the team's success on the soccer field to justify their own position. And of course, there were others. One other one I can mention briefly that might be of interest, because it actually backfired, was that immediately after a series of sort of sham elections in 2009, which were meant to boost legitimacy for that government, the entire retinue, the entire sort of all of the top people in the military government actually went to South Africa to be seen cheering for the team, to again associate themselves with the Honduran soccer team. And this happened at exactly the same moment that there was a major outbreak of dengue fever in the country. And people were dying. There was a serious epidemic in the country of dengue fever, and the regime looked really patently absurd, because the health minister was off in South Africa cheering for the soccer team rather than being in Honduras. The president was in South Africa cheering for the soccer team rather than being in Honduras while all of this was going on. And to make matters worse, part of the reason that the outbreak had happened was that there hadn't been the proper process of sort of insect control, mosquito control, that would normally be part of the public health sort of system, that had all been disrupted by the military coup itself. And so those things hadn't happened, which had led to this dengue outbreak. And while that was going on, none of the people supposedly in charge of the country, none of the people who placed themselves in charge of the country were even in the country to do something about it. They were off in South Africa trying to gain popularity by being linked to the soccer team. So those are just a couple of the ways that they tried to build their popularity by associating themselves with the soccer team.
How did the international soccer community respond to the coup?
Well, the soccer community didn't have necessarily much of a response at all, except insofar as the situation in Honduras was so violent, it was so bad, the repression was so bad, the country was rocked for, immediately after the coup, of course, people, took to the streets, and you had daily demonstrations, massive demonstrations every day after the coup, and of course those were met with violent reaction from the state, from the military and police, and so the level of state violence that was being parsed out upon people was so great that a number of international soccer teams refused to actually play in Honduras, and matches that were scheduled to be played in Honduras were played elsewhere. They'd be played in other countries because these international teams, although they didn't want to get involved in the actual politics of the problem, they acknowledged that it was very unsafe, for their own teams. There were actually there was violence at soccer matches in Honduras. There was an episode where police were shooting at people who were leaving one of the stadiums. There were actually four or five different violent episodes at soccer matches. So the international soccer community didn't have any position on the coup itself, but they certainly acknowledged that it was an incredibly dangerous situation and that they should not put their own players and their own teams at risk by going to Honduras during that time, which I think, although it isn't a political statement, it certainly does say something about the level of repression, the level of violence that was going on at the time, which, of course, in the end would fly in the face of some of the things that the Canadian state said about Honduras.
Now, in your article, you also describe struggles that have been taking place over several sports fields located in poor neighborhoods throughout Honduras. Explain that a little. What's the significance of these events?
Yeah, this was a series of stories that I was told by a friend of mine who lives in a poor community called Flor del Campo, which is a suburb of Tegucigalpa, the capital city. It's a very poor neighborhood, and it's also a neighborhood that is very strong in terms of its organization, community organization, that is. So the community is very well organized. They're very involved in the broader resistance movement to the coup, and in many ways their form of resistance to the coup often takes place in very small scale, very immediate, sort of community-based campaigns and projects, ranging from fixing the water distribution in the community to fighting to protect spaces for kids to play. And that's where this sort of fit in with the soccer element, which the stories that I was told were about these sort of different events where, in one instance there was a public basketball court that the kids would use to play. I mean, they play basketball, but they play other things. It was just, the way kids use space, right? They just use it however they want to use it. And so the kids had this sort of public space, basketball court, and a proposal was put forward by the mayor to take half of the basketball court and turn it into part of a private kindergarten. And it's important that it was a private kindergarten. It would be a kindergarten, obviously, where most of the kids who were playing in the basketball court would not be able to afford to go to this new kindergarten. So the kids, and it was driven by the kids went to some of the notable sort of organizers in the community and said, here's what's happening, is there something we can do about this? And people got together and they organized a number of events to pressure the mayor to stop. They had a whole bunch of big demonstrations. The kids had their cameras, they went to the mayor's office, they did a number of things, and they managed to block the sort of concession to create this private kindergarten on their basketball court. which I thought was just an amazing story. And it turned out that that wasn't the only one, and that in fact there is a similar thing that is sort of still in process, a similar thing going on with respect to the biggest soccer field in the neighborhood. And again, big public soccer field, you know, not very well taken care of, mostly dirt, not a lot of grass, but public and available for all the kids to use. And the proposal, again, is to privatize it, to turn that soccer, to build a fence around it, to put some lights up, to put in some new grass, and then to charge kids to be able to play there. And the number I was told was that kids would be charged $20 for like an entry fee to get into the soccer field to play, which, of course, would just, you know, be an exorbitant amount of money for most of these kids. And so, again, the community is organizing to fight back against that, and that's sort of an ongoing struggle, and I don't really know where it's at this point, but as of about a month ago, they were doing the same things. They were organizing, they were building or making pamphlets, they were, you know, organizing demonstrations to go to the mayor's office and fight about this and so on. So that, to me, was really inspiring. I think that's the kind of community activism that just really, really impresses me. And it's funny that it comes back to sport again, and you know, and it's about a place for kids to play that all kids have access to. So, yeah, that to me really struck a chord.
Moving a little bit away from sports, it's no surprise to say that Canada's interest, quote-unquote, Canada's government interest, is based around investment in Honduras. What are those main areas of investment that Canadian capital has?
Yeah, the Canadian interest in Honduras, I think there's a number of specific industries, and then I think there's also some broader geopolitical interests. But specifically in terms of where Canadian capital is invested in Honduras, is mostly in places that you wouldn't be surprised to hear. Mining, of course, is huge. You know, the notorious gold companies, Barrick Gold, Gold Corp, of course, are very active in Honduras, as they are in a lot of places in Central America. There's also the tourist industry in the North Coast, which a lot of people are only starting to wake up to the fact that Canada is so involved in the tourist industry. There are a number of Canadian companies that have cropped up who are not only purchasing pieces of the land on the North Coast to turn them into resorts, but also to turn them into private residences for you know, sort of Canadian retirees, snowbirds, you know, who want to go and find some place in the sun to live out their years. And of course, they're doing this on land that is traditional indigenous land. It's Garifuna land, or it's owned by campesino communities and so on. And it's being sold to Canadians under some very sketchy circumstances. And then, of course, garment industry is another that's really big. And again, this wouldn't surprise anybody. Anyone who's familiar with the operations of Gildan, a Montreal-based clothing company, in Haiti, well, it's the same in Honduras. Gildan is the largest sweatshop company in Honduras, the largest garment industry company. They have at least four, I think maybe five, major operations. Thousands of women work for their sweatshops under truly deplorable conditions. And I'm happy to go into more detail if you're interested, but I wouldn't bog you down, but you know, certainly everything that you can imagine about a sweatshop, it's all there, and it's all pretty distasteful. So those are the three major areas of capital investment.
Right. Those may be less familiar, more familiar, but at least the general scope of it is something our listeners would have a consciousness of, but they may not be aware of the Canadian military presence in Honduras. Maybe we can close with a sketch of what that's about.
Yeah, the Canadian military presence is hard to pin down because it's very... it fits into what is becoming a really nefarious version of the military side of imperialism, which is much less about soldiers on the ground, much less about sort of occupation forces on the ground, and much more about training you know, training in sort of counter-insurgency tactics. So, you know, one thing that the Canadian military has been very involved in is doing training for the Honduran military. And this is a military, of course, that has seized control of the state, you know, and has done so via violence and repression. There have been thousands of people killed in Honduras in the last 3 years. Not all of it can be directly linked to political violence, but a lot of it can be indirectly linked to political violence, and of course some of it can be directly linked to political violence. So we're talking about a very deeply, deeply repressive military machine, sort of security apparatus, because it involves the police as well, and private security as well. And the Canadian military has been very involved in training for these for the military, for the police, and the training is in counterinsurgency tactics, which of course is, I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the sort of the lingo of counterinsurgency. This is, you know, this is what we were doing in Afghanistan. This is what we do in Haiti. This is what imperial armies in Canada and the United States and elsewhere are sort of reorienting themselves towards. It's this kind of low-intensity warfare against anyone who would block the expansion of capital in a particular space, or anyone who would block the political apparatus that is needed to protect the expansion of capital. So in a context like Honduras, counterinsurgency means cracking down on organizations that are coming together to resist the military coup, organizations that are coming together to protect campesino land, organizations that are coming together to protect the rights of workers. These are the types of organizations and groups that get targeted in counterinsurgency programs. And that's something that Canada is actively involved in, because we are training the Honduran military to do that. We're also very involved in training and actually some on-the-ground work with respect to the so-called counter-narcotics campaigns, right? These sort of the war on drugs, which has been, you know, absurdly ongoing for some 30 years, this war on drugs that can't seem to stop the drugs, but manages to kill a lot of people who are involved in social movements, manages to kill a lot of people who are involved in serious activism, serious social movement activism. And of course, the massacre in the Mesquitia just a few weeks ago, by the DEA, the United States Drug Enforcement Agency, is, you know, a really telling example of what's really happening with these counter-narcotics programs.
Thank you for explaining that, and thank you for making the links in sport and politics.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the chance to talk about this stuff.
Bye-bye.
I know.
I've been speaking with Tyler Shipley. He recently launched a new online magazine called Left Hook, which brings together progressive and critical views on popular sports. And you can Google Left Hook, and you'll find the link there.